Ladies and gentlemen, coming at you live from his own bedroom, your host, Tony. What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls? Welcome back to another episode of Time Out with Tony, your host, Tony. All right, ladies and gentlemen, episode 13. Today, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be reviewing a case, well, that is about to be, it's about to hit its 18th year anniversary. I'm talking about the disappearance of Mara Murray. Now, you may have heard of this case, you may have not. Either way, we're going to be diving into that case today. Now, this is a case that, for me, has stuck out in my head for years to come, mostly because of the events that led to her, to this woman's disappearance and what happened after, and the fact that literally no trace of her has been found after this night at all. No cell phone, no credit cards, keys, nothing like that. Not even, you know, a confirmed actual sighting, you know? That's what's really crazy about this case. Not only that, but, you know, this was a case that, you know, this is a case that happened literally days after Facebook first launched, all right? A lot of people consider this to be the first crime of the social media age. I don't really consider it like that, though. To be fair, this was, you know, almost 18 years ago. What do I know? I was still shitting in my diapers, so... What can you do about it? Anyways, ladies and gentlemen, before we get into today's episode, I want to take a quick minute and thank you guys all so much for the support. It means a lot, really, so keep it up. And most of all, tell everybody. Tell your mom, tell your dad, tell your coworkers, tell the postman, tell everybody. And yeah, that's pretty much it, folks. Also, we'll be announcing our giveaway in next week's episode, so be sure to tune into next week's episode for a little bit more of a thorough breakdown of this giveaway that we're having. It's exciting. It's cool. I'm very, very happy about it. Anyways, ladies and gentlemen, enough banter. Let's get straight into today's episode. So sit back, relax, and crack open a beer, soda, and your water, and enjoy, folks, because this is the disappearance of Mara Murray. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's take a quick rundown of this case. So, Mara Murray, she was an American woman who disappeared on the evening of February 9th, 2004 after a car crash on Route 1112 near Woodsville, New Hampshire, a village in the town of Haverville. Her whereabouts to this day remain unknown. At the time of her disappearance, she was a 21-year-old nursing student that was completing her junior year at the University of Massachusetts Amherst at the time of her disappearance. On the afternoon of Monday, February 9th, before she left the university campus, she emailed her professors and her work supervisor, writing that she would be taking off a week due to a death in the family. Weirdly enough, according to her family, they had not experienced a death at that time. At 7:27 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, I think it was, a local woman reported a car accident on a sharp corner of Route 1112 adjacent to her home. A passing motorist, who also lived nearby, stopped at the scene and asked the woman driving the car if she needed assistance. She declined, claiming that she had called roadside assistance. Upon arriving home several minutes later, the motorist reported the accident to emergency services. At 7:46 p.m., law enforcement arrived at the scene and no trace of Murray was found. Police traced the vehicle to Murray and initially treated her as a missing person on the belief that she may have wanted to disappear voluntarily. The speculation was based on her travel preparations, about which she had confided nothing to friends or family, and no obvious evidence of foul play. In the year 2009, Murray's case was given to the New Hampshire Cold Case Division, and authorities are handling it as a suspicious missing persons case. In the years following Murray's disappearance, Case would go on to receive media attention on 2020 and disappeared. It also garnered significant speculation on internet message boards and forums, with theories ranging from abduction to even voluntary disappearance. In 2017, the case was the subject of a documentary series on the Oxygen Network, which described Murray's disappearance as, quote, the first crime mystery of the social media age, end quote, having occurred days after the launch of Facebook. Now, the only reason I feel like the case got to where it was, well, let's be honest, white missing woman syndrome is a real thing, alright folks? And I feel like that's the only reason why this case was very intriguing. Anyways, let's do a bit of a background. So, Maura Murray, born May 4th, 1984 in Hanson, Massachusetts. She was the fourth child of Frederick and Lori Murray. She had an older brother, Fred Jr., and two older sisters, Kathleen and Julie, and a younger brother by the name of Kurt. Maura was raised in an Irish Catholic household, and when she was six, her parents divorced, after which Maura lived primarily with her mother. She graduated from Whitman-Hanson Regional High, where she was a star athlete on the school's track team. There, she was accepted into the U.S. Military Academy in West Point, New York, where she went on to study chemical engineering for three semesters. After her freshman year, she transferred to the University of Massachusetts Amherst to study nursing. In November 2003, 3 months before her disappearance, Murray admitted to using a stolen credit card to order food from several restaurants, including one in Hanley, Massachusetts. The charge was continued in December to be dismissed after 3 months of good behavior. On the evening of February 5th, 2004, while she was on duty at her campus security job, Murray spoke on the phone with her older sister, Kathleen. They discussed Kathleen's relationship problems with her fiancé. At around 10:30 p.m., while still on her shift, Murray reportedly broke down in tears, and when her supervisor arrived at her desk, Murray was, quote, just completely zoned out. No reaction at all. She was unresponsive, end quote. Supervisor escorted Murray back to her dorm room at around 1:20 a.m. When asked what was wrong, Murray just said two words, my sister. The contents of this call remained unknown until October of 2017 when Kathleen publicly explained the conversation. Kathleen, who at the time was a recovering alcoholic, had been discharged from a rehabilitation clinic that same evening, and on her way home, her fiancé took her to a liquor store, which caused an emotional breakdown. On Saturday, February 7th, Murray's father, Fred, arrived in Amherst and told investigators that him and Murray went car shopping that afternoon, and later went to dinner with a friend of his daughter. Murray dropped her father off at his motel room and borrowed his Toyota Corolla and returned to campus to attend a dorm party. There, she arrived at 10:30 p.m. and at 2:30 a.m. on Sunday, February 8th, she left the party. At around 3:30 a.m., while en route to her father's motel, she hit a guardrail on Route 9 in Hadley, causing nearly $10,000 worth of damage to her dad's car. The responding officer wrote an accident report, but there's no documentation of field sobriety tests being conducted. Murray was driven to her father's motel and stayed in his room for the rest of the morning. At around 4:49 a.m., there was a cell phone call placed to her boyfriend from Fred's phone. The participant of the call and the content of the phone call remain unknown. Later Sunday morning, Fred Murray learned about the damage done to his vehicle and learned that the damage done to his vehicle would be covered by auto insurance. He rented a car and dropped off Murray at the university and departed for Connecticut. At around 11:30 that same night, he called his daughter to remind her to obtain accident forms from the registry of motor vehicles. They also agreed to talk again Monday night to discuss the forms and to fill out the insurance claim via phone. After midnight on Monday, February 9th, Murray used her personal computer to search MapQuest for directions to Berkshire and Burlington, Vermont. The first reported contact Murray had with anyone on February 9th was at 1 p.m. when she emailed her boyfriend, quote, I love you more, stud. I got your messages, but honestly, I didn't feel like talking too much of anyone. I promised to call today though, end quote. She also made a phone call inquiring about renting a condominium in the same Bartlett and New Hampshire condo association with which her family had vacationed in the past. Telephone records indicate the call lasted 3 minutes. The owner in the end did not end up renting any condos to Murray, and at 1:13 p.m., she called a fellow nursing student for reasons unknown. At 1:24 p.m., Murray emailed a work supervisor of the nursing school faculty that she would be out of town for a week due to a death in her family. No one in her family had died. She also said that she would contact them when she returned. At around 2:05 p.m., Murray called a number which provides recorded information about booking hotels in Stowe, Vermont. The call lasted approximately 5 minutes, and at 2:18 p.m., she telephoned her boyfriend and left a voice message promising that they would talk later. The call ended after 1 minute. In her car, Murray had packed clothing, toiletries, college textbooks, and birth control pills. When her room was searched later, campus police discovered that most of her belongings had been packed in boxes and the art was removed from walls. It's not clear whether Murray had packed that same day, but police say at the time that she had packed most likely between Sunday night and Monday morning. On top of boxes was a printed email to Murray's boyfriend indicating trouble in their relationship. At around 3:30 p.m., she drove off the campus in her black 1996 Saturn sedan. Classes at the university had been canceled that day due to a snowstorm. Must be nice. At 3:40 p.m., Murray withdrew $280 from an ATM. CCTV footage showed that she was alone, and at a nearby liquor store, she purchased about $40 worth of alcoholic beverages, including Bailey's Irish Cream, Kahlua, vodka, and a box of Franzia wine. Security footage again shows that she was alone when she made that purchase. At some point in the day, she also picked up an accident report form from the Massachusetts Registry of Motor Vehicles, and she left Amherst between 4 and 5 p.m., presumably via Interstate 91, and she called to check her voicemail at around 4:37 p.m., which was the last recorded use of her cell phone. To this date, there is no indication as to whether she had informed anyone of her destination or any evidence that she had chosen one. Sometime after 7 p.m., a Woodsville, New Hampshire resident heard a loud thump outside. Through her window, she could see a car up against a snowbank along Route 112, also known as Wild M. Nusack Road. The car was pointed west on the eastbound side of the road. She telephoned the Grafton County Sheriff's Department at 7:27 p.m. to report the accident. According to the 911 log, the woman claimed to have seen a man smoking a cigarette inside the car. She later went on to state that she had not seen a man nor a person smoking a cigarette, but rather what appeared to be a red light glowing from inside the car, potentially a cell phone. At about the same time, another neighbor saw the car as well as someone walking around the vehicle. She witnessed a third neighbor also pull alongside the vehicle. That neighbor, a school bus driver returning home, noticed that the young woman was not bleeding or visibly injured, but cold and shivering. He offered to telephone for help. She asked him not to call the police, one police report says pleaded, and assured him that she had already called AAA. AAA has no record of any such call. Knowing that there was no cellular reception in the area, the bus driver continued home and called the police. His call was received by the sheriff's department at around 7:43 p.m. He was unable to see Murray's car while he made the call, but did notice several cars pass on the road before the police arrived. Another local resident driving home from work claims that she passed by the scene at around 7:37 p.m. and saw a police SUV parked face to face with Murray's car. She pulled over briefly but did not see anyone inside or outside the cars and continued home. This witness's statement contradicts the official police log, which has Haverhill police arriving 9 minutes later. According to the official police log, at around 7:46 p.m., a Haverhill police officer arrived at the scene. No one was inside or around the car. The car had impacted the tree on the driver's side of the vehicle, severely damaging the left headlight and pushing the car's radiator into the fan, rendering it inoperable. The car's windshield was cracked on the driver's side, and both airbags had been deployed. The car was locked. Inside and outside the car, he discovered red stains that were turned out to be wine. Inside the car, the officer found an empty beer bottle, a damaged box of Franzia wine on the rear seat, and in addition, he found a AAA card issued to Murray. Blank accident forms, gloves, compact disc, makeup, diamond jewelry, driving directions to Burlington, Vermont, Murray's favorite stuffed animal, and Not Without a Pearl, a book about mountain climbing in the White Mountains. Missing were Murray's debit cards, credit cards, cell phone, none of which has been located or used since the day of her disappearance. The police also reported that some of the bottles of purchased liquor were also missing. Journalist Joe McGee, who wrote for the Quincy, Massachusetts Patriot Ledger, summarized the incident, saying, quote, "At a hairpin turn, she went off road. Her car hit a tree. At that point, a person came along who was driving a bus. It was a neighbor. He asked if she needed help. She refused, and about 10 minutes later, the police showed up to the scene, and Marl Murray was gone." between 8 to 8:30 p.m., a contractor returning home from Franconia, a young person moving quickly on foot eastbound on Route 112, about 4 to 5 miles east of where Murray's vehicle was discovered. He noted that the person was wearing jeans, a dark coat, and a light-colored hood. He did not report it to police immediately due to his own confusion of dates. It was only after discovering 3 months later, when reviewing his work records, that he had spotted a young person the same night Murray disappeared. The responding officer and the bus driver that drove around the area searching for Murray just before 8 p.m. EMS and a fire truck arrived to clear the scene. By 8:49 p.m., the car had been towed to a local garage. At about 9:30 p.m., the responding officer left, and a rag believed to have been part of Murray's emergency roadside kit was discovered inside. Was discovered stuffed into the Sens muffler pipe. Authorities would refer to Murray as simply missing at 12 p.m. the next day, almost 24 hours after the last confirmed sighting of her. At 12:36 p.m. the following day on February 10th, a Be on the Lookout report was issued for Murray. She was reported as wearing a dark coat, jeans, and a black backpack. A voicemail was left on Fred Murray's home answering machine at 3:20 p.m. stating that her car had been found abandoned. He was working out of state and did not receive the call. At around 5 p.m., Murray's older sister contacted her father to tell him of the situation. He then contacted the Haverhill Police Department and was told that if Murray was not reporting safe by the following morning, the New Hampshire Fish and Game Department would start a search. At 5:17 p.m., Murray was first referred to as missing by Haverhill Police. On February 11th, Murray's father arrived before dawn at Haverhill, and by 8 a.m., New Hampshire Fish and Game, the Murrays, and others began a search. The police dog tracked a scent from one of Murray's gloves 100 yards east from where the vehicle had been discovered, but the scent was lost. This suggested to police that she had most likely left the area in another car. At 5 p.m., Murray's boyfriend and his parents arrived in Haverhill. He was interrogated in private and was then joined by his parents for questioning. At 7 p.m., the police said they believed Murray came to the area either to run away or to attempt suicide. Her family believed this was unlikely. Murray's boyfriend had turned off his cell phone during his flight to Haverhill. At some point, he received a voicemail that he believed was the sound of Murray sobbing. The call was traced to a calling card issued to the American Red Cross. On February 12th, Murray's father and her boyfriend held an evening press conference in Beltham, New Hampshire. The next day, the first press coverage was published. At 3:05 p.m., the police reported Murray might be headed to the Kankamagas Highway area, and she was listed as endangered and possibly suicidal. The police also reported that Murray was intoxicated at the crash site, although the bus driver said she did not appear impaired. The Haverhill Police also said that, quote, "Our concern is that she's upset or suicidal." About a week after her disappearance, her father and her boyfriend were interviewed by CNN's American Morning. Murray's family expanded their search into Vermont and dismayed that authorities there had not been informed of her disappearance. Although missing person cases are normally handled by local and state police, the FBI even joined the investigation 10 days after she disappeared. The FBI entered family from Massachusetts, and the Haverhill Police Chief announced that the search was now nationwide. 10 days after her disappearance, New Hampshire Fish and Game conducted a second ground and air search using a helicopter with a thermal imaging camera, tracking dogs, and cadaver dogs. Murray's older sister discovered a ripped white pair of women's underwear lying in the snow on a secluded trail near French Pond Road on February 26th, but DNA tests concluded that the underwear did not belong to Murray. At the end of February 2004, the police returned the items found in Murray's car to her family. On March 2nd, the family checked out of the motel exhausted from the search. Friend Murray went on to return nearly every weekend to continue searching. In April, Haverhill Police informed him of complaints of trespassing on private property. The March 2004 disappearance of Brianna Maitland in Montgomery, Vermont, 66 miles away from Murray's last sighting in Woodsville, drew comparisons from media and law enforcement due to similarities in disappearances. However, state police stated there are no links between the two cases. In April and again in June, New Hampshire and Vermont police dismissed any connection between Murray and Maitland. In a press release, they stated that they believed that Morrow was headed for an unknown destination and may have accepted a ride in order to continue to the location, end quote, adding that they discovered no evidence that a crime had been committed. They dismissed the possibility of a serial killer being involved, and on July 1st, the police retrieved items found in Murray's vehicle from family for forensic analysis. On July 13, a 1 mile radius search was performed by nearly 100 searchers, including state troopers, rescue personnel, and volunteers. It was the fourth search around the crash area and the first search performed without snow on the ground. Authorities were most interested in locating the black backpack Murray had in her possession but not found in the car. Police stated that the search discovered nothing conclusive. In late 2004, a man allegedly gave Murray's father a rusty stained knife that belonged to the man's brother, who had a criminal past and lived at less than a mile from where the car was discovered. His brother and his brother's girlfriend were said to have acted strangely around the time of the disappearance, and that the man's brother claimed that he believed that the knife had been used to kill Murray. Several days after the knife was given to Murray's father, the man's brother allegedly scraped his Volvo. Family members of the man who turned in the knife claimed that he had made up the story in order to obtain reward money, as he had a history of drug use. You can never be too safe when reading these murder cases. You hear a thump in the back and all of a sudden you think it's over. Anyways. In 2005, Fred Murray petitioned the New Hampshire Governor Craig Benson for help in the search and appeared on the Montel Williams show in November to publicize the case. On February 9th, 2005, the first anniversary of Murray's disappearance, a service was held where the car was found and her father met briefly with the New Hampshire Governor John Lynch. In late 2005, Murray filed a suit against several law enforcement agencies with the aim of seeing files on the case. On November 1st, a user named Tom Daves logged into a message board called Not Without Peril, which was dedicated to a discussion of Murray's disappearance and claimed to have seen a black backpack behind a restroom at the Pejuase Overlook around 30 miles east of the Woodsville Road on Route 12. Murray owned a black backpack. And Senior Assistant Attorney General Jeffrey Streslin stated that law enforcement was aware of the backpack but did not disclose whether it had been taken in for forensic testing. The New Hampshire League of Investigators, 10 retired officers and detectives, and the Molly Bish Foundation started working on the case in 2006. Tom Shamshak, a former police officer and member of the Licensed Private Detectives Association of Massachusetts, said, quote, "It appears that this is something beyond a mere missing persons case. Something ominous could have happened here," end quote. The Arkansas group Let's Bring Them Home offered a $75,000 reward in 2007 for information that could solve her disappearance. In October of 2006, volunteers led a two-day search within a few miles of where Murray's car was found. In the closet of an A-frame house approximately 1 mile from the crash site, cadaver dogs allegedly went, quote, bonkers, possibly identifying the presence of human remains. The house had been formerly been the residence of a man implicated by his brother, who had given Fred the rusty knife in 2004. A sample of the carpet from the home was sent to the New Hampshire State Police, but the results were never released to the public. In July of 2008, volunteers led another two-day search through the wooded areas in Haverhill. The group consisted of dog teams and licensed private investigators. Murray's case was one of many cited by proponents of a statewide cold case unit for New Hampshire, in 2009. Her case was subsequently added to the newly established cold case unit later that year. In 2010, Fred Murray publicly criticized the police investigation for treating the disappearance as a missing persons case and not a criminal matter. He called on the FBI to join the investigation. Jeffrey Streslin said in February 2009 that the investigation was, quote, still active. We don't know if Morrow was a victim, but the state is treating it as a potential homicide. It may be a missing persons case, but it's being handled as a criminal investigation, end quote. In 2014, on the 10th anniversary of Murray's disappearance, Streslin stated, quote, "We haven't had any credible sightings of Murray since the night she disappeared, end quote. In an article published in the New York Daily News on the 10th anniversary of her daughter's disappearance, it was reported that Murray believed she was dead. Sorry, it was believed that Fred believed that her daughter, Sorry, it was reported. Oh, chingada madre. It was reported that Fred believes she was dead and had been abducted the night of her disappearance. On her 13th anniversary of her disappearance, Streslin wrote in an email to the Boston Globe, quote, "It's still an open case with periods of activity, and at times it goes dormant. There are no new updates to share at this time." On the 15th year anniversary, Fred Murray reiterated his belief that his daughter was dead, as well as suspicions about the nearby house that the cadaver dogs responded to, stating, quote, "That's my daughter, I do believe." In early April, excavation was done to the place within the basement of the house. Fred Murray had previously wanted to search the home, but the owners did not cooperate. After the sale of the property, the new owners allowed several searches of the property since February, and the excavation conducted in early April found absolutely nothing other than what appears to be a piece of pottery or old piping. In early 2021, the tree at the site where Murray was last seen, which had been marked with a blue ribbon as a memorial, was cut down by the property owner. Shortly after, a request from Murray's family to have a New Hampshire historical marker placed at the site, which had been submitted in late 2020, was turned down by the New Hampshire Division of Historical Resources. On September 14th, 2021, the New Hampshire State Police announced that bone fragments had been found on Loon Mountain in Lincoln, New Hampshire, approximately 25 miles east of where Murray's crash had taken place. Murray had been to the mountain before and had knowledge of the area, according to his sister. Bone fragments were described as pretty small, and it was expected to take at least 2 months to determine whether the remains belonged to Murray or not. Last month, it was announced that the remains were not of Murray's, unfortunately. Murray's disappearance to this day has been cited as the first crime mystery of the social media age and generated speculation from the media and public, specifically on the internet and online forums and message boards. Writing for Boston Magazine in 2014, Bill Jensen noted, quote, "Now, at least online, it often seems as there's no such thing as a cold case. But when Mara disappeared, the social web was in its infancy. There was no YouTube, no Twitter. On the day Mara went missing, Facebook was only 5 days old. And so you can read the history of her case and a parable about the evolution of online sleuthing," end quote. In 2005, active discussion of Murray's disappearance was documented on websleuths.com, and in 2007, Facebook and MySpace pages were created dedicated to help finding her. I think that's pretty much it, folks. Yep, that's pretty much it. My theory is that she was a bit hellbent on leaving, you know, suggesting, as you know, everything she had packed. I feel like she was, you know, in the process of just sort of maybe moving, and it was like one of those surprise things, or maybe it was just one of those things where she was like, bro, I keep hearing one too many bangs outside. I feel like, never mind. Anyways, yeah, no, what was I gonna say? Oh, right. Personally, I believe she was in the process of going somewhere, and because, you know, she wanted to go there so badly, she might have, you know, gotten into the wrong stranger's car and... Or maybe, you know, she just crashed and was abducted right on site. Though, to be fair, the woman would have noticed and told the authorities, unless this is a whole conspiracy. In which case, we gotta make a whole other episode on this, but... Who knows, folks? Let me know what you guys think. What do you guys think happened to Mara Murray? Let us know on Instagram. And yeah, that's pretty much it, folks. This pretty much wraps up today's episode, folks. I want to thank you guys all so much for the support. It means a lot, really, so keep it up. And most of all, tell everybody. Yeah, tell everybody. Giveaway coming soon. Stay tuned for that. And yeah, that's pretty much it, folks. We'll see you guys next week. Take care. And most of all, don't drink and drive, folks. Okay, show's over. Please get out. Thank you.